Well, thanks for having me back another week. I didn't mean to hide the title from Pastor Smith. It does say a deeper look. Today, I want to try and get a little bit about Darwin. Not quite his science yet, but who was he, the man? How did he arrive to the point that he created this theory? I think that's kind of important for us as Christians to understand that. So I'm going to do some quick review. I have a box up here. Anybody remember what my box was? Okay, it's the universe. And how does that relate to this topic? Or how could it relate to this topic? I think it should. Okay, if you think everything is contained within this universe, all natural law, all governing bodies, then that's all there is. That's kind of a materialist view. But if you believe that God is transcendent outside of the universe, you have a whole different belief system, a whole different control system, a faith system that is different. So we do have worldviews in conflict on this topic. So Bible verses we had last week, I gave you that list. I went over this one. Just think about one man, sin brought judgment. One man's sacrifice brings justification. Man. We know who that is. It's the first Adam, the second Adam. But I said last week as a caution, we can believe differently on some of these topics that I'm going over. Age of the earth, things like that. And still be saved. Because we need to believe on the Christ. Who was the Christ? Who was the anointed one? And we need to believe that God raised him from the dead. Sounds like a different thing, raising. Because fully man, fully God, raised from the dead, the man. You've got to think about that in this debate. For as in Adam, this is a couple other verses that we've had, all die, even so in Christ, all shall be made alive. 1 Corinthians 15:22. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. So all of these verses, including these, are personhood statements. We're talking about a person. People live, die. Truly man, truly God. That is part of this debate, what you believe about that. So I have homework for you. This time I do want you all to look it up. You know, I can't force you. I'm not coming to your home. I'm not going to even punish you if you don't. No, you're not my students. Of course, I never really punished them, I don't think. Where are my students? Oh, I'm getting some looks. Maybe I did. So you have homework. I want you to look up this passage of Scripture. And if you were paying attention last week, it was part of your sermon. It was part of your sermon. So 2 Peter 3, 1-7, part of that was actually on your list anyhow, so maybe you've looked it up. But what is the Apostle Peter trying to tell us in this passage? And how does this, you should think, how does that relate? So we're going to go over some things today. I have a few definitions that'll be up there very quick because we had them last week. So not everything's going to be quick. But I want to try and get the man's, at least his early life in and his voyage on the Beagle. So evolution, we had that textbook definition from the textbook Trinity uses. It's a secular textbook. And I started to indicate evolution. When we say the word evolution, we don't think micro and macro. The world doesn't think that. They just say evolution. And they just kind of synthesize the two into one without a whole lot of thought. Microevolution is changes like changing beak size, color size, length of legs, hair. So you still have a change, but it's very minor. In macroevolution, you have a whole new animal, a whole new species. Micro, we see. Macro has never been demonstrated. Okay? Yeah, micro really, when you look at what's going on, of course, Darwin didn't know what was going on. He didn't know anything about genetics. It's selection of genes and expression of them. And there are factors that will cause other genes to be selected, like a geographic bottleneck, a mutation that gets passed on. There are some things. But we'll get into mutations later, because I think that'll probably be next week. So again, what's the problem I left you with? The problem is that macroevolution is believed to produce large-scale changes. Micro results in changes within a population within the same species. But time and time again, they are both said without ever identifying one or the other that we're talking about. No distinction in meaning. So you have that. No distinction in examples. This example just applies to that. And does it really? We need to be discerning. No distinction with respect to the evidence. We should assume the evidence for one because we see the other. That could be a problem. I would submit it is a very big problem. So it results in a confused public. So that's kind of where we were last week. So if you hung in with me through the whole talk, hopefully you were thinking along this vein. So Charles Darwin, he is credited with being the father of evolution. You know, you think of evolution, Darwin comes to mind, and rightly so. He was born in 1809, lived till 1882. There's a picture of him about the age, or a portrait actually, about the age that he went on HMS, the HMS Beagle, the famous voyage that one of you identified to me as arriving at the Galapagos. You may not know this. He studied medicine at Edinburgh. Or they don't even say the but it's just kind of a groveling. He did not finish. How about this one? Did anybody know this? He studied theology at Cambridge. He did not finish. So this is Darwin. Two attempts at going into a career that he did not finish, and we'll get into a little bit of why. December of 1831, he has an opportunity. He joins the crew of the HMS Beagle as a naturalist. Well, naturalist, what is that? Somebody who looks at nature. It's not really an official position. But Darwin, you cannot take this away from Darwin. He was excellent at observing nature. In fact, he was so excellent at it, that's all he wanted to do, that and hunt. He was in a wealthy family. He could afford to do nothing but hunt and look around nature and be a man of leisure. So that became a problem for his father, as you've probably experienced or may experience, that sometimes there's conflict between what I want to do or don't want to do and what my family wants me to do. So he was born, let's get the date, February 12th. Now, does anybody know that date in history? For us Americans, if you're into history and into people of fame, that might be a very important date. Thank you. It is Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Very good. Very good. He was 22 years old at the time of the voyage. Now, if you were in my class, right now I would activate that link, the theme song, because the voyage was supposed to be 2 years. So I always reminded of Gilligan's Island. A three-hour tour. Yeah, you could probably sing it. Weather started getting rough, all that stuff. So I play that for them, and of course the video comes up, and some of them even know who it is. But I won't do that to you. And it returned in 1836. This is why I find the relationship to the three-hour tour. The two-year voyage became a five-year voyage. I don't know how I'd feel if I signed on for that, you know? I think of scurvy and all those things. So, voyage of the Beagle. So, we're going to take you on that voyage. It starts out up here in jolly old England, right? We are going to South America. His job, or the job of the ship, was to do mainly geologic surveys along this coast. That's what their job was. That's what they were commissioned to do. That's what King Henry IV wanted them to be doing. So they're going to South America. They go around, or right past Tierra del Fuego. I just put that on there because I like to say that word, Tierra del Fuego. Through the Strait of Magellan, where they go. They end up at this little chain of islands up here. So let's give the rest of perspective. Of course, I left out Central America. There's the U.S. And me being a child of the 50s, growing up in grade school in the 60s, my America, on all my Rand McNally maps, looked much larger than it really is. Did you know that? That these maps were published, that the U.S. was bigger than it was supposed to be? It's part of our pride. Maybe we need a little more pride, but I don't know if that's the way to do it. So the old U.S. of A is pretty big. Not that big, though. So there's his voyage. He ends up in the Galapagos. Does anybody know where he goes from there? Most people don't. The assumption is, I mean, I want to go home. I'll go up here and I'll go through the canal. Oh, no canal. Can't do that. So maybe you retrace your steps and go back home. That sounds good, but that's not what they did. From the Galapagos, they went to Australia. Little known fact. Well, not little known, but most of the public is not conscious of it. They come from Australia, and once again, if it were me, I'm tired of my 5-year tour. I'm going to go right up to jolly old England again. But they didn't do that either. They went back and collected more samples. Thus the 5-year tour. On this tour, I'll back up. Again, very influential family. Very wealthy family. In fact, his father, you know, you talk about aristocracy. He was born during probably the tail end of the Enlightenment. I have the book by Thomas Paine, The Age of Reason. It's always been on my reading list. Maybe now that I'm retired, I'll actually read it. Because just hear, what was their thinking back then? But he is born when all of these ideas are being fomented in society. Naturalism, rationalism, you know, this man's reason. He attended the Church of England. At this time, the Church of England was probably pretty fundamental in the beliefs and the preaching. But it was under attack by these ideas. So he was born during that time, during a church under attack. His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was a physician, a poet, and he's often talked about as a free thinker. We today might categorize him as a little bit of a radical. He was so free thinking. He was an evolutionist. He was an evolutionist without a cause. He would put things out in his writings. So you can imagine little Charles being bounced on Grandpa's lap, right? And just being preached evolution. He died in 1802. But Charles had his books, his writings, his poetry. So as he grew up, this was very important to him. So I'm going to, I put a credits up here because what I did, a video I have, and if you saw my video library of creation, evolution videos, I don't know, I've never counted them. I know it exceeds 50. If someone said it was 75, I probably couldn't argue until I sat down. But I said there were some good videos in there, so rather than me using some slides I made, I'll just take still shots of some things they used. So this is from the evolution of Darwin, his early life. So here's one of the writings of Dr. Erasmus Darwin. Organic life beneath the shoreless waves was born and nursed in ocean's pearly caves. First forms minute, unseen by spheric glass, moved on the mud or pierce the watery mass. These are successives. These, as successive generations bloom, new powers acquire and larger limbs assume. What's it sound like? It's evolution. It's an evolution story, right? There were a lot of people who were evolutionists before Darwin. But the problem was they didn't know the how. The reason we call Darwin the father of evolution, he came up with the how. And it seemed plausible. So, why did he study medicine? Well, you saw his grandfather, Erasmus, was a physician. You saw his father, Robert, or maybe you didn't see his father. You knew his father was upset with him from what I've told you. He was also a physician, but he was beyond physician. He was an investor, a businessman. He owned half of the town in England, literally, that Darwin grew up in. They were that wealthy. And then his brother, also Erasmus, I put Avery or Alvy, his middle name, to distinguish him. He has a medical degree, but I couldn't find, nor in the video that I have, the Dace Finder support that he actually practiced medicine. But he did complete and get a medical degree. So there's a little pressure. You are in a family that's aristocratic, that has a tradition of being physicians. You go to medical school. So why'd he drop out? Can you think of medicine back in 1825, 27? What would it be like? What didn't we have? We could bleed you, yeah. Yeah, we did that and killed George Washington. I don't know if you guys know that. Medicine killed our first president. But it was worse than that. Think Civil War, what those men went through who were wounded. No antibiotics, no anesthetics. So what was very distasteful to Darwin, and he writes about it, was that part. Clinical medicine was before the age of anesthesiology. So, gruesome. It was truly gruesome to be a surgeon, to be a person of medicine back then with the limited knowledge and limited equipment. And so he did not like what he was seeing in his clinical studies. And he soon found out doctors were not judged by skill. They were judged by speed. Because the quicker you could get the pain over, the better doctor you were. Right? So the whole thing he found distasteful. That's why he quit medicine. So when I say he didn't finish, he probably did have the aptitude. It was in his family. You know, so we're not talking an aptitude here. We're talking a taste. Or maybe a lack of drive. Maybe it was a combination. But he didn't finish, and that's probably why. So why did he study to be a clergyman? You failed out of medical school, right? So that he could put us all to sleep. I think he just said that. So why clergyman? You're an aristocratic family. You need to have social standing. So far, you haven't really enamored yourself to the family, but this was a very respectable profession. Okay? So, his family was disappointed with the medical failure. They wanted respectability. So he goes off to follow the family's wishes. This is from his autobiography, what he said about that time. I asked for some time to consider, as from what little I had heard and thought on the subject of being a clergyman, I had scruples about declaring my belief in the dogmas of the Church of England. Though otherwise, I like the thought of being a country clergyman, right from his own handwriting, his own autobiography. So, sounds good. You know, it's not so bad, respectable. I'll work my one day a week and have my other six. Joke between Pete and I. To go out and do my nature thing, right? So this was something that it intrigued him, so he started. And as I did not then in the least doubt the strict and literal truth of every word of the Bible, I soon persuaded myself that our creed must be fully expected. Sounds good. He's talking himself into it. But again, he's writing this late in life, and he adds this. It never struck me how illogical it was to say that I believed in what I could not understand and what is, in fact, unintelligible. Unintelligible. Beyond understanding. That's where he was. So he has a conversation with Bishop Herbert. Now, in the Anglican Church, my daughter's father-in-law went through an ordination in the Anglican Church. I don't know if right before they were married or since they've been married. I can't remember the timing. But I remember in talking to him, because he had been in the PCA with me, but he went to that because he liked the higher church and the liturgy. And he could also be ordained fairly quickly in that church. But his ordination today relied heavily on sponsorship by a bishop. So he was teamed with a bishop. So I assume that this goes back traditionally in that church. And this was the bishop who was going to be in the ordination service and giving him the orders, right? So he asked the bishop. Darwin had asked Herbert whether he really felt inwardly moved by the Holy Spirit to enter the church. When the bishop put the question to him in the ordination service, what would he reply? So he wanted to know what the bishop thought when he was going through the same thing. And the bishop said, no, he couldn't say that he felt moved like that, like at least moved like what Darwin was looking for. So I told you Darwin did not finish his theological studies. Following that conversation, he chimed in, well, as part of it, but then following it, he dropped out. Neither can I. I therefore cannot take the orders. So people that want to say that his doubts and what he wrote about the Bible in those previous quotes, oh, they came later in life. They already started when he was in seminary. So let's go back to Darwin on the Beagle. You have a little flavor for what he was like. Well, I'm telling a lot of stories. I better hurry up. So you can't see that as well. Here's his ship, the HMS Beagle. Here's three influences. I'll talk about three men who highly influenced him. And he's seeing geologic changes. He's coming back and he's looking at changes in animals. He was into pigeon breeding, and he knew you could selectively breed traits you wanted. He knew dogs could, domesticated animals could. So he comes down here and figures, how do they adapt? I need to come up with a mechanism for adaptation. So since you can't see that, we'll just move on. So the first person is a naturalist, a French naturalist, Georges Buffon. And he had put writings out that said, as he looks at fossils, the earth is very old. That was an influence on Darwin. Second one was Charles Lyell, probably originally the most influential man. He was a Scottish geologist. He proposed that geologic processes, such as erosion that you see take place, that's how the whole earth was formed, wind and erosion over eons of time. And it published, I think, 8 volumes on this work. And all this could explain the physical features of the earth. That's called uniformitarianism. When Lyell wrote this, it was brand new. Darwin got on the Beagle and actually was given 2 volumes by the captain of the Beagle, a family friend. Because of something new, he went, oh, he's a naturalist, he'll like this. He gifted it to him because Darwin's real job on the Beagle was to be the companion to the family friend, more than a naturalist, but they called him that because it gave him a title. Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. He is another French naturalist. He proposed that by using certain body parts, you would acquire traits you could pass on. And it was the law of use and disuse and the inheritance of acquired characteristics. If you ever see, and maybe I'll bring one in later, Lamarck thought that giraffes had a long neck because because they started stretching and needing to get higher trees to compete. And as they stretched, they got a trait that their neck grew, and they passed it on to their offspring. That's what he believed. Sounds ridiculous to us today, but that's how you acquired these characteristics. Totally reasonable in that era, because we didn't know anything about genetics. And Thomas Malthus, he was an economist from England, and he wrote papers about population growth. And it's going to grow so fast, we'll outgrow our natural resources and people will die, famine, pestilence. Darwin saw this as a struggle for existence. So those were three main men that gave him concepts. So his voyage lasted from December 27, 1831 to October 2, 1836. Like I said, he was supposed to do geologic surveys of South America, commanded by Robert Fitzroy, and there's something about why the family really got him on the boat. Fitzroy was a close personal friend of his father. So Fitzroy said he was a close personal friend. He had been an admiral in the Royal Navy before he went into private. So he was very high ranking and well thought of. And it would be unseemly for an admiral to hang out with his crewmates back in that era. So again, another reason Darwin was on board. Here's something about Fitzroy that a lot of people don't know. He was a fundamentalist Christian. So as Darwin's developing this, his captain is appalled. At least of the conversation, because he didn't write it until much later. So again, I said he read the first two books of geology by Charles Lyell, 39 months on land and 18 months at sea during this voyage. The majority of his observations were geological, not zoological. And we know this because we have his notes. 1,383 pages of geological, only 368 pages of zoological notes. Personal notes were much higher, 779. So where'd they go? They went, a lot of their study was this region, what we call the Patagonia. Very wild region. When you hear Patagonia, I know what you think of. You think of some outdoor clothing, right? Well, originally, it was given its name for a wild region of Argentina. When I was in Argentina and touring it, I rented a car to go down and take me into the Patagonia to take me to the Chilean border. And I never made it. I saw a little bit of the Patagonia, not as wild as I wanted to see. And I didn't make it because we were stopped by so many armed men with military out uniforms that wanted to check papers. Maybe 4, 5, 6, I don't even remember. But they were mean looking and they can check all they want. So my driver told me, we're not going to make it. We will never get across the border and get you back for your flight. You know, I had like the whole day, I thought. Got up early in the morning, hired a driver. So he took me to a town way up in the Andes, the last town that was actually an army base, and we had lunch there. And then we turned around and we left and got all the checks on the way back. And so I didn't see much of it, but it's beautiful. It's just phenomenal mountains and valleys. So Darwin, as he's reading Charles Lyell, he's looking at these huge valleys that come out to the ocean. And he's got this theory of uniformitarianism. This all happened over eons of time. Slow, natural causes. He's seeing mountains that are just unique in their look and formation and huge. So the thoughts of slow geologic ages to form great valleys and mountains gradually over time led him to his similar biological considerations, that this is what's going to happen. So Darwin believed, from that thought of uniformitarianism, that the present is the key to the past, was something that he really believed in. Meaning, if I see it happen in this amount of time today, I extrapolate, and that's what's going on. So the present is the key to the past. Remember that. It's very key to evolutionary thought. It's a major tenet of uniformitarianism that Charles Lyell was presenting. So, Darwin, another quote from his autobiography. Whilst on board the Beagle, I was quite orthodox, but I had gradually come by this time to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian. So he has a transformation. He goes from, I'm studying to be a clergyman. I can't take the orders. I don't feel something really drawing me, calling me to be that. To going on to a boat, because his parents wanted him to get on with life and make something of himself, with this family friend who was quite orthodox, to doubting orthodoxy altogether, that this was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus and the barbarians. So that's the man. That's the man. Lyell's work went on beyond Darwin. This whole thought of abandoning catastrophe in favor of uniformitarianism. Before Lyell, most geologists were catastrophists. Things were shaped through catastrophe. What catastrophe can you think of that would have shaped things? The flood. The flood. It's Lyell's work, Darwin's work, that reversed all that. The present is the key to the past. Until recently. You know, God still has dominion. God still can reveal himself. And he revealed himself through two things that happened in North America. So we are witness to these. The first, I guess we didn't witness the scab lands, but they're there. I think it shows up fairly good. Can you see why it's called the scab lands? It's in eastern Washington. So if you come over the mountains through the desert into eastern Washington, you will see these miles and miles of scab lands. And it looks like scabs on the face of the earth. In fact, the only other structures like this are on Mars. Kind of interesting. So just some other views of it. So you have these deep valleys, these high, these things are like 400 feet high, these waterfalls and things you're looking at. All over the place, just like scabs. And they don't run in one direction. They run in multiple directions. Think of if I dropped a lot of water, just a deluge of water. Would it run in one direction? Probably not. Probably multiple. So there's a geologist, J. Harlan Bretz, who was studying this, and he said this is can only be explained through catastrophe. I feel sorry for this guy. He's working in the 1920s, and he describes it as a series of large braided channels separated by small islands of actual, those, you know, higher elevated things. The channels cut through the lava-formed rock in uphill and downhill directions. Very strange the way it's cut through. And he stated, they head on the back slopes and cut through the summit. They could not be more erratically and impossibly designed. So he is saying catastrophe, catastrophe. He attributed the formations to large-scale catastrophic flood. He was ridiculed. Or, as one person who tried to befriend him and say, hey, could you say it was a large glacial lake that let loose? This flood thing, large catastrophe, maybe make your catastrophe a little smaller. So he said, or it could be that. He was not just ridiculed for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I don't know how he endured it. 40 years of ridicule. But he was still a professor. At that time, they just didn't cut you out. You weren't canceled, but you weren't invited to a lot of things. And he still took his students to continue his studies meticulous studies. Finally, in the 60s, they wanted to shut him up. A group of geologists, highly acclaimed geologists, even geologists from the USGS, the United States Geological Service, went with him to the site. And they had to admit, he might be right. So they did a study in the 70s of open channel hydraulics. All these studies were done to show what would happen through a catastrophic event like a huge flood or a lake that was so huge caused by a glacier. What could it form? And the conclusion of that group, it formed scablands. So all those years from the 1820s to the 1970s, geology started to deny any catastrophe of large-scale nature. And right in our backyard, the scablands, they finally, as geologists, had to admit. So that was the first one. So we're in the 70s. Mount St. Helens, also in Washington State. When did we go visit that, Gene? Was that like 95? I thought so. In 1980, this erupted. And this huge peak, a lot of it got blown out. In fact, a third of its elevation blew out one side. We went and visited it 15 years later, and it was still devastation. And every now and then, you'd see a little pine tree about that big. So, in Mount St. Helens, these canyons were formed. They're 1/40th the size of the Grand Canyon. And they were formed in 3 days. One volcano, one eruption that we witnessed. I hope you can see how that sediment is layered, layer upon layer of different degrees, graduation, and different consistency. So in a three-day period, they formed finely layered strata in just 3 hours. You saw miles of the strata laid down. This would be, in geologic time, millions and millions and millions of years. The present is the key to the past? Not so much when you're saying the present erosion rates of slow erosion build up that sediment. 3 hours for millions of years. Learnings from the catastrophe at Mount St. Helens. Now, we learned a lot. There are 6 things. Talk about rapid cooling, rapid coal and petrified forest deposition and creation, or what will become those, rapid layering that I've already shown you, rapid canyon formation, I've kind of shown you that too, new lava, and old radiometric dates. One of the things people are interested in is radiometric dating. I want to get into that in one of these talks. Rapid soil and animal recovery now. 15 years, yeah, we could see grasses and all that and small trees. Well, 40 years later, it's all back. So, rapid cooling. When the eruption went off, one volcano, it was measurable that there was a change in the temperature of the Earth. And it happens with every volcano. And this isn't the biggest. But you can measure that cooling. Imagine if thousands of them went off. The upwelling of the deep. The blast radius covered 11 states, reached as far as Minnesota and Oklahoma. How that got there, don't ask me. But there were deposits of the ash, huge deposits all the way in Oklahoma from some wind stream that brought them down there. So in the forest, these look like matchsticks dropped. Those are trees. There's 230 square miles of them just bent over, gone. Just to show you, here's a tree, just so you get a sense for the power blowing it. When Jeannie and I were in Seattle on the Puget Sound, we went to one of those IMAX-type theaters to watch a video of the eruption. Phenomenal. I mean, some of the video, the people with the cameras were running away. If you've ever seen the movie Who's the guy who forgets everything? Walter Mitty. That one blast scene they show you is an actual blast scene that they've edited into. And that hot steaming gas is coming. Well, there were photographers running for their life, and you know, as it came at them, and some did not make it, and neither did the film. But the ones who made it, so it's directional. Just to give you scale, here's a man, here's a tree. These were huge trees. These weren't just little saplings. They were huge, huge trees. I had another picture. I told Vicki when I stopped by Trinity, I'd love to show it to you, but it had a copyright on it, and I'd have to buy it to show it to you. But I could buy for $300 an unlimited amount of prints. So anybody want to pitch in so you can have a pretty picture? This is Spirit Lake, and this is a log mass that floats on it. The logs are all denuded of their bark because they rub together. The bark is in the lake, forming peat. So these floating log beds are forming peat deposits, which will be eventually coal. And the logs, the ones that aren't laying this way, are some starting to go upright. I have a film where a guy scuba dives down in those logs, and you can see stratified logs that eventually, as the peat builds up around them and sediment, they will be trapped. So there's some up top. They estimate that there's 20,000 of them that are doing this. And we wonder, one of the big enigmas for geology with slow, eventual, gradual processes is this kind of tree that is a petrified tree that goes through 70, 100 million years worth of strata. But there it is. How does that happen? How does that happen? Is it uniformitarianism? Slow, gradual? The present is the key to the past, or is it catastrophe, like we see on that lake? Again, looking at that finely stratified region, these volcanic blast ash deposits, the landslides, the mudslides, were the largest actually in recorded history, by the way. These combined to produce sediment layers up to 600 feet thick. Not just what you're seeing there, but 600 feet thick. So, rapid canyon formation, again, we've looked at it. 150 feet of sediment was into the Toutle River coming out of there. Second eruption, 2 years later, triggered mud flows and snow melts that cut canyons up to 140 feet deep in a single day. On record, we've seen this. So here's the dome. It's kind of hard to see that picture. here's one of the things that the reason I want to get into radiometric dating. That dome was dated, rock from that dome, at 350,000 years old. This is a dome formed within 10 years after the blast, the new dome. We know it's 10 years old. That's our dating method. Individual minerals within that dome, it gets worse. 2.4 million years old. We know they're 10 years old. And you hear about this all over the world, like in 100-year-old volcano lava. In Hawaii has been dated to like 70 million years old. There's all kinds of inconsistencies. Well, why are they in that dating? We need to look at that. Okay, at the time we knew it was 10 years old. So as far as the rapid recovery, gophers were already making new soil out of the 6 feet of pumice. They were tunneling through it, making it into soil. Elk came back really early, which amazed people. Salamanders, they found salamanders that have migrated miles from creek to creek. They go, how did that happen? And that's a picture of 40-year anniversary, and it doesn't show up as good up there, but you can see it's well forested again. So, like it or not, catastrophe is back on the table. So I'm a little bit over, but I want to show you the last two slides. I think there's two more. I want to ask you, is the present the key to the past, slow and gradual, or did catastrophe have a part in what we see? So back to Darwin. He published Origin of Species in 1859. We'll spend some time on that next week. But here is a comment that I want to leave you with. I shall never forget the meeting of the combined sections of the British Association when at Oxford in 1860, 1 year after the published work, where Admiral Fitzroy, fundamentalist Christian, expressed his sorrows for having given you, Charles Darwin, the opportunity of collecting facts for such a shocking theory as yours. We'll leave it there. So thanks for listening. Can I close in prayer? Father God, I thank you for the opportunity to be here today, to speak with people, to look at a man's life, because truly, things are revealed in character as we look at Charles Darwin. Things are revealed in belief. Same as if we looked at ourselves, Lord. So keep us to have our eyes on you, our eyes on truth, our eyes on the means of grace that you've availed to us. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.